Picture this. You show up for a Saturday morning flight. Weather brief is done. Flight plan is filed. You grab the keys off the board at the front desk. You walk out to the ramp and you work through your pre-flight. Everything looks good outside. You climb in, flip on the master switch, start working through the panel, and the vertical speed indicator is stuck at zero and won't budge, or the left fuel quantity gauge is pegged full even though you just physically check the tank and it's not, or you go to test the landing light and nothing happens. What do you do? I'm Pattern on Traffic Pattern, here on Radio Hangar, and today we're walking through Federal Aviation Regulation 91.213, which is exactly the regulation that answers that question, because I have seen more students stumble on oral exam questions about inoperative equipment than almost any other topic. And more importantly, I've seen real pilots on real pre-flight mornings make the wrong call because they didn't have a clear framework in their head. So let's build that framework together. Before we get into it, a quick word about aviationsoul.com. They make challenge coins for pilots, and they cover every step of the journey. First solo, private pilot certificate, instrument rating, commercial. Each one a physical marker of something that was genuinely hard to earn. If you're training right now, or you know someone who just hit a milestone, check them out, aviationsoul.com. All right, Regulation 91.213. Here's the core idea in plain English. Just because something is broken on an airplane does not automatically mean the airplane is unairworthy. And just because something is broken does not automatically mean you can fly. The regulation gives you a decision process, a set of questions to work through before you make the call. Let's walk through those questions in order. Question 1. Is the inoperative item required by an airworthiness directive? Airworthiness directives, or ADs, are mandatory orders the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, issues when they identify an unsafe condition on a specific aircraft type. If an AD says that a particular piece of equipment must be operational on your aircraft, and that equipment is broken, you're not flying. That is the end of the conversation. Call maintenance. So check your aircraft's AD compliance log. This is part of understanding your airplane's airworthiness. Most rental aircraft have this handled by the flight school's maintenance department, but you need to know where to look and what it means. If no applicable AD covers the broken item, move to question 2. Question 2. Is the inoperative item required by the kinds of operations equipment list? Pilots call this the KOEL. And you say it like the name Joel with a K in front. The kinds of operations equipment list lives in your pilot operating handbook, or POH. Typically in Section 2 or Section 7, depending on the aircraft. It lists equipment installed in the airplane and whether each item is required for specific kinds of operations. Day visual flight rules, or VFR. Night VFR, instrument flight rules, or IFR, and so on. Here's where students get tripped up. The KOEL does not say an item is required for all flying. It says whether the item is required for the specific kind of flying you're about to do. Let me give you an example. On most general aviation aircraft, position lights are listed as required for night VFR operations. Makes sense. The regulations require them at night, but if your left position light is burned out and you're planning a daytime flight that will be completed well before sunset, check your KOEL. It may not be required for that specific operation. Conversely, if you're planning a night cross-country and your KOEL says position lights are required for night operations and yours aren't working, you're not flying tonight. Here's the other layer that students often miss. The KOL in your POH is a manufacturer document. The FAA's regulations, specifically 91.205, have their own required equipment list. That's the ATOMATO flames mnemonic. Most of you learned for the knowledge test. Night operations have additional requirements under 91.205. Instrument flight has its own list. So you're actually cross-referencing two things. The regulatory minimums from the federal regulations and the manufacturer's KOL for aircraft-specific requirements. If the broken item is required by either source for the operation you're planning, you don't fly until it's fixed. If it's not required by either, you keep going. On to question 3. Question 3. Is there a minimum equipment list, or MEL, approved for this aircraft? Now, and MEL is not something most private pilots in general aviation deal with every day. EMELs are more common in commercial and charter operations under Part 135 and 121, but some general aviation operators do have FAA-approved MELs. And if your airplane has one, it takes precedence as a document. And MEL is essentially a contract between the operator and the FAA. It specifies which pieces of equipment can be inoperative under what conditions, and sometimes with what required crew actions or operational restrictions. Flying with an EMEL gives you more flexibility than the baseline Part 91 rules, but it comes with its own discipline and documentation requirements. If your airplane has an EAL, use it. If it doesn't, continue the decision tree. Question 4. Is the broken item required by the aircraft's type certificate datasheet? Every certificated aircraft has a type certificate datasheet that defines the approved configuration of that airframe. If equipment is required by the type certificate to be installed and operational, its status matters to your airworthiness determination. This layer is more technical than the others, and a good airframe and power plant technician, what most of us call an ANP, can help you work through it for a specific aircraft. If the item clears all of those questions, you arrive at the operational decision. Question 5. Can the inoperative item be deactivated or removed and then placarded as inoperative? This is the key practical step. If the item is not required by any of the above, the regulation says you may continue the flight provided the equipment is properly deactivated and a placard is placed in clear view of the pilot stating that the item is inoperative, or the equipment is physically removed from the aircraft. The placard matters. It is not just a sticky note for appearances, it tells every subsequent pilot who climbs into that cockpit that this instrument or piece of equipment should not be relied upon. In a moment of high workload or stress in flight, you don't want to glance at a broken fuel gauge and make a fuel management decision based on information that isn't real. Now, here's a nuance that trips people up. Can you, as the pilot, deactivate something and placard it yourself? It depends on what needs to be done. If deactivation is as simple as pulling a circuit breaker that the maintenance manual authorizes the pilot to pull, or switching something off with a guard, the pilot may be able to handle that. But for anything that requires opening panels, removing components, or any actual maintenance work, you need an ANP to perform and log that work. This is where student pilots and renters sometimes make an uncomfortable mistake. They convince themselves that something is not required and just fly anyway without properly deactivating or placarding the item. That is not legal, and more importantly, it defeats the entire safety purpose of the regulation. Let me walk you through some real scenarios because the abstract language is a lot easier to absorb when you've practiced the thinking. Scenario 1. You're pre-flighting a Cessna 172, and the vertical speed indicator is pegged at minus 200 feet per minute with the engine off and nothing running. It's stuck. Work the questions. Any AD requiring the vertical speed indicator to be operational? Check the compliance log. Is it required by the COEL for day VFR? Pull out the POH and look on most Cessna 172s. The vertical speed indicator is not required for day VFR operations. Is it required by 91.205? No. The VSI is not on the required instrument list for day VFR, so the decision tree says this item is not required for your planned operation. Now the question becomes whether an ANP can properly deactivate and placard it. In many cases, yes. You document it, the mechanic handles the deactivation, the placard goes on, and you fly without relying on that instrument. You just don't use it. Scenario 2. Same pre-flight, same airplane. But this time the altimeter is behaving strangely. You set the current ATIS altimeter setting, and the indicated altitude is significantly off from the known field elevation. More than just the usual few feet of slop. Now you have a different problem. The altimeter is required equipment for both day and night VFR under 91.205. An inoperative or significantly inaccurate altimeter means the aircraft is not airworthy for VFR flight. End of discussion. Notify maintenance. Do not fly. Scenario 3. The front landing light is burned out. It's 9 in the morning and you're doing a local flight that will be back on the ground by noon. Landing lights are not required for day VFR operations under 91.205. Check your specific POH COIL to confirm the same for your aircraft. Assuming it clears with proper deactivation and placarding, you may be legal to fly that daytime flight. But here's the judgment call I want to leave you with. Legal and wise are not always the same thing. A burned-out landing light at 9 in the morning might be legal for a local flight. But what if the flight runs long? What if the weather delays your return and you find yourself arriving at dusk? You've made a decision early in the day that affects your options and your safety margins later. I'm not saying don't fly. I'm saying make a real decision, not a lazy one. Know what you're committing to before you start the engine. Scenario 4. You're on a cross country, you've landed at an unfamiliar airport, and you discover mid-trip that the transponder has stopped transmitting. You're not in Class A airspace, but your planned route takes you through the shelf of Class B airspace above a major city. A Mode C transponder is required in that Class B airspace. You cannot route through it without one. This doesn't necessarily mean you're stuck at the airport forever. You can call approach control, explain the situation, request handling as a non-transponder aircraft. You may be able to route around the airspace or under it, Or you may be able to get a special flight permit from the nearest FAA Flight Standards District office to fly the aircraft to a maintenance facility where the transponder can be repaired. Special flight permits exist for exactly this kind of situation. An aircraft that is not airworthy for normal operations can sometimes be authorized for a ferry flight to maintenance. It's not routine, but it's a real option, and knowing it exists keeps us stuck at an airport situation from becoming a crisis. Now, let's talk about what comes after you've made your decision on the ramp. If you determine the aircraft is airworthy despite an inoperative item, that item's status needs to be documented in the aircraft maintenance records, a logbook entry by an authorized person. If you're a student or a renter, the flight school typically handles this, but knowing it needs to happen and asking whether it's been done is part of acting as a responsible pilot in command. And if there is any doubt, if you can't find the right section of the POH, if the maintenance records don't have a clear answer, if you're not sure whether a required AD applies to your specific serial number aircraft, you're grounded until you have a clear answer. Uncertainty is not an acceptable operational status. "I think it's probably fine" is not a regulatory determination. The Airman Certification Standards for the Private Pilot Practical Test expect you to understand this decision-making process. On your oral exam, your examiner might describe an airplane with a broken item and ask you to walk through your reasoning. What the examiner is looking for is not a recitation of the regulation number. They want to see you work the logic. Is it required by an AD, by the COEL for this specific operation, by the required equipment regulations? If not required, what's the proper path to deactivate and placard it? Who needs to be involved? What gets documented? If you can walk through those questions calmly and in order, you're going to handle this topic on your oral just fine. More importantly, when you're standing on the ramp some Saturday morning with a broken gauge and a cross-country you really want to fly, you'll make a clear, defensible decision instead of a rationalized one. The last thing I want to say is this. Regulation 91.213 is a decision framework. It is not a loophole. I've seen pilots use it as a loophole. They look for any reading of the regulation that gets them in the air on the day they plan to fly. I've seen those decisions end badly. The regulation trusts you to run the analysis honestly, to consult the right documents, to bring in maintenance when maintenance is needed, and to make a conservative call when you're genuinely uncertain. If you treat it as a framework for making a truly airworthy decision every single time, it's one of the most useful regulations in Part 91. It gives you structure and authority on the ramp instead of guesswork. Part 91 of the Federal Aviation Regulations is your primary source on this, specifically Sections 213 and 205 together. Your aircraft POH is the other document you need open. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Pattern. Be honest with yourself out there.